Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Well, it's October 30th, and we have a tradition here at Ask Dr. Dawn. We spend most of Halloween talking about scary stories. At least I have a few scary stories. I also have some hopeful and optimistic ones about a scary disease. So let's start with the traditional evil laugh. Now that I've gotten that out of my system, let's start out with the enemy lurking in your fridge and possibly in your pantry. Spoiled foods. Many spoiled foods contain specific microorganisms with lovely poetic names that produce toxins. Now, depending on a person's ability to process these foreign chemicals and the amount that they are exposed to, which can vary widely, there are no absolute guidelines on what's safe to eat, but it's a good idea to know your enemies. So let's take a little walk on the wild side. And let's start out with nuts and grains and something that existed in the Middle Ages called St. Vitus Dance. And St. Vitus Dance was essentially a movement disorder and peripheral neuropathy caused by a toxin that liked to grow, that comes from the fungus called ergot and likes to grow on grain, particularly grain that gets damp because, hey, if you're a mold, you need dark and damp are your favorite things. There are a lot of molds that we have to worry about with foods, and we'll be discussing some of them tonight. They're pretty, actually. They form fuzzy little patches, green, yellow, black, or white. If you take a sniff, don't get too close and don't take too big a sniff, you can often smell that musty cellar smell. Mycotoxins are the chief toxins, obviously, poison, right? It's the cousin, mold is the cousin of mushrooms, and mushrooms produce, or some of them do, terribly dangerous mycotoxins. The two most common fungi found on grains and nuts, especially corn, rice, and peanuts, are Aspergillus flavus and Aspergillus parasiticus. And for those of you who are perhaps mold sensitive, you might want to be very careful with these. Particularly peanuts. Peanuts produce mycotoxins called, or mold growing on peanuts, I should say, produces mycotoxins called aflatoxins. And these form molecules which are called epoxides. Epoxides are very nasty. They can trigger mutations as they bind to DNA. Repeated exposures to aflatoxins, perhaps from moldy peanuts bought from a machine in a rainy winter, could damage the liver, and repeated exposures have been linked to liver cancer. This is especially bad for people who are already at risk, such as those who have had hepatitis B or hepatitis C, and those who drink. Another type of fungi found on grains such as wheat, barley, or corn is called fusarium. Fusariums may cause a pinkish or reddish hue to the grain, so watch out for that. Fusarium fungi produce mycotoxins called tricholothecines, which damage cells and irritate the digestive tract. They also make another toxin, because why stop at that, called fumonisin B1. This can harm the liver and kidneys because it disrupts how cells build and maintain their outer membranes. So Long story short, if grains or nuts look moldy, discolored, or shriveled, or if they have an unusual smell, it's best to err on the side of caution and throw them out. Aflatoxins have no known safe level of exposure. So I actually have made it a point to avoid peanuts for quite some time. If you are going to be purchasing peanuts, you really should check them over carefully before turning them into peanut butter. Moisture in the bins at health food stores can actually allow for the production of aflatoxin, or they have been reported. So you really need to give a good hearty sniff after you start dumping things in the bag. And if you do buy grains from bins, in general, it's important to buy them from places where the bins turn over frequently. It's no guarantee, because there's a transport, and depending upon how they're transported, where they're stored, and whether there was a leaky pipe somewhere, you can still get mold. So careful examination where possible, particularly for peanuts, strongly recommended. Now, when I think about fruit, I think about two of my most favorite fruits, tomatoes and apples. Tomatoes are technically a fruit, by the way. So when fruit become bruised, if they're stored in damp conditions, mold can easily take hold. The major one is a blue mold called Penicillium expansive. It infects apples, but also can get cherries, peaches, and other fruit. It produces a toxin called patulin. This interferes with key enzymes in cells and tends to hobble normal cell functions and generate unstable molecules called reactive oxygen species that can harm DNA, proteins, and fats. In fact, we can test the lipids in your blood for evidence that you have high levels of reactive oxygen species, by the way. Because it tends to affect the membranes of cells, and as those cells break down, we can measure the levels in the blood. Major organs are affected by this: liver, kidney, digestive tract, and the immune system. There are two other Penicillium species, Digitum and Italicum. Those are frequent flyers on oranges, lemons, and citrus fruits. Boy, do I encounter those. I'm always buying bags of oranges and then not eating all of them. They taste awful, and they're easy to spot. So you're not going to want to eat that fruit anyway. It's tempting to just cut off the moldy parts and maybe eat the rest. However, the molds that you're seeing on the surface have deep tap-like root structures called hyphae that penetrate deeply into the food. So they can release toxins even into seemingly unaffected bits. So for soft fruits like tomatoes, where hyphae can grow more easily through the soft flesh, just toss out any moldy tomatoes. For hard fruits like apples or pears, I generally recommend cutting off the half that has the mold on it. You're probably not going to get a significant dose, but of course it's safer, and particularly for elderly and children whose detoxification systems are not as well developed, just throw it out and go buy some more fruit. Now, you get a little touchy on the subject of cheese, and we differentiate when we're talking about toxins in cheese, because cheese actually are the product of controlled beneficial microbial growth. Mold is a crucial component in many of the cheeses you know. Blue cheeses like Roquefort and Stilton get their flavors from a fungus called Penicillium roqueforti. And the soft white rind on cheeses such as Brie or Camembert contributes to their flavor and texture. Watch out for greenish, black, or reddish molds. These are often caused by Aspergillus, and these are toxics. Some penicillin species, like Penicillium commune, produce cyclopiazonic acid. That sounds so sci-fi, doesn't it? A mycotoxin that disrupts calcium flow across cell membranes. This could potentially impair nerve functions. At high enough levels, this is known to cause tremors and nervous system symptoms. Such cases are rare because spoiled dairy products generally give themselves away by their sharp, nasty odor. As a general rule, soft cheeses, such as ricotta, cream cheese, and cottage cheese, need to be discarded at the first sign of mold because they're so moist that by the time you see mold on the surface, those filaments and hyphae have probably spread through the entire cheese. Hard cheeses like cheddar, Parmesan, and Swiss, much less porous, much like baked hard clay soil, those roots from the moss, from the fungus, are not going to get in there easily. So cutting away about an inch around the moldy spot is more of a safe bet. Just remember not to touch the mold with your knife. This is true across the board. And put that, decontaminate that knife, and that means hot water. See, cooking doesn't really get rid of most of these toxins. While molds are the primary concern for plant and dairy, bacteria are the main agents of meat decomposition. The first thing to look for, particularly in sliced deli meat, is a change in texture, a slimy texture. If you see any kind of greenish or brownish discoloration, that's that, or a sour or putrid odor. But some harmful bacteria don't produce any changes to smell, appearance, or texture. So that smell is caused by chemicals that have lovely names, cadaverine and putrescine. And dogs are extremely sensitive to this smell, and to them, it smells wonderful. These, if you consume them, can cause headache, flushing, drops in blood pressure, nausea, vomiting, and abdominal cramps. So if it stinks, don't drink. Well, that I was searching for the rhyme, but don't eat it either. E. coli is commonly contaminating beef. It produces a toxin which can cause a dangerous kidney disease called hemolytic uremic syndrome. People's kidneys can shut down. Some of the long-term residents here will remember a E. coli, I think it was omega-157, which got into the fresh, unpasteurized apple juice. How did it get into apple juice? Well, the answer is it got in from runoff from cow pastures. And so if you eat groundfall apples anywhere near where animals could be defecating, you're really taking a substantial risk. And it's extremely important to watch out for those apples and clean them well. Back to the meat. Poultry often carries the bacterium Campylobacter, which produces a toxin that invades gastrointestinal cells, leading to diarrhea, abdominal cramps, and fever. It is a very, very nasty toxin, and is the elderly, because they are so vulnerable to dehydration, are particularly sensitive to it. So undercooked chicken, a chicken that has sat out on the counter before cooking, this is a real problem. Salmonella is often found in chicken. In fact, if chicken is of the mass-produced variety, the way that it is cleaned, you sort of need to proceed on the assumption that it contains salmonella. This releases a toxin which is heat-stable, so you can't get rid of it by cooking, and it causes diarrhea, nausea, and abdominal cramps. These toxins get into the lining of the gut and drive extensive inflammation, leading to leaky gut, and that can be a semi-permanent condition. There's also Clostridia perfringens, another fecal organism that makes its way into meat, and Clostridium botulism, of course, which we primarily see in improperly stored or canned meats, and most people know about botulism. It's one of the most biologically lethal poisons up there with not quite so bad as cyanide, but definitely a very, very serious biological toxin. Meat always has some bacteria, but the longer it sits in your refrigerator or on your counter, the more those bacteria multiply. And as I've said, you can't cook the yuck on those toxins away. Or at least you can't rely on it. So, wow. That is our first Halloween story. Oh, looks like we have a caller coming in. Hello, you're on the air. Tell me your name and where you're calling from.
My name is John. I'm from Santa Cruz.
Hello, John from Santa Cruz. What can I do for you this evening?
Well, a couple different things. I forget the name of the retail like candy distributor, except they were in like Valley Fair, and they would have quote yogurt covered peanuts. Mm-hmm. And what I found was that the peanuts were rancid.
Right,
you could taste it.
Well, the mold could grow under the yogurt coating too, because it's a dark moist space.
yeah. And then that to another topic, you were saying botulism. Isn't Botox a derivative of botulism?
Well, all of the neurotoxin anti-wrinkle treatments that are given by injection, and they not just anti-wrinkle, that's the primary use, but they're also used in people with hyperhidrosis, where they sweat excessively, or they're used for migraines, they're used for lazy eyes, strabismus. So there are many other uses, more legitimately medical. But in terms of the marketplace, the first one, Botox, was developed for a clinical cause. They all contain essentially the same exact toxin, which is botulinum A, but they have a different salt, the cogener, they're called. So think about magnesium. You can get magnesium oxide. You can get magnesium citrate. You can get magnesium glycine, etc. But it's all magnesium. And that's pretty much how that wide range of Botox products are. And they're all pretty much the same. So yes, you're right. The amount of Botox, if you bought it in the little 100 unit vials and wanted to poison somebody, you could probably hire a professional assassin for cheaper, because it's going to cost you many thousands of dollars to buy that much toxin to kill somebody with. There have been a few murder mysteries where that's been done. And if you are if you work for a clinical laboratory and cook the books, you might be able to order enough industrial Botox, because it is sold for laboratory experiments and such. So I don't know what the market price for that is, but it's considerably cheaper than the human grade, rather like veterinary medicine.
Okay. I have one final question. I'm 75, and in the past few years, I've developed a propensity for, I'd say, paper-thin skin on my forearm, on my body, such that I scratch it and it just bleeds and bleeds, and then after a period of time, it doesn't bleed anymore. Is that a nutritional problem, or is it just getting old?
Is it primarily areas that have been fairly heavily sun exposed, like the forearms and back of your hands?
Yeah, I surfed many, many years, and that was always exposed.
And so I'm sure your nice little white butt, is the skin is much better.
Oh yeah.
And you would have a hard time making that skin bleed. So over time, with particularly UV radiation, both your collagen and your elastin, which is I'm sure you've had underwear that just got all stretched out. Well, that literally happens to your skin, and because it doesn't have that stretchy spring holding it in place, it is very vulnerable to shear forces. So rubbing or just brushing against the edge of something is enough to catch the skin and tear the blood vessels that are supposed to be protected by the elastic, but now they're the thing that takes the shear force, or the vector. They absorb the vector and they break. They're not built for that. and a lot of people will get these purple blood pools under their skin. There is not much you can do for that, except I have had some success cosmetically with topical vitamin K. And there is a fairly pricey product called Dermal K that you can rub on your forearms, and after about, oh goodness, several months, you may notice some improvement. My recommendation, however, is you can buy these sleeves that are flesh-colored that are kind of like opera-length gloves, you know, the sort of mid-20th century Holly-Golightly glove that goes to the elbow. And those are perfect, and they make them in all sorts of groovy colors, and you can also buy just colorless ones. And if you want to commit the cardinal sin of buying from Shein, you can, which is one of the Chinese fast fashion houses, you can buy them. You can also get them on Amazon if you just ask for gardening gauntlets. They'll usually show up. They're a soft lycra kind of smooth thing. So they lubricate and protect the skin from being stretched by your activities. And they're quite effective. And the flesh-colored ones, I bought a pair. And, you know, right up on top of you, someone's going to see that you're wearing them. But it's much less noticeable than the big purple blotches. So if you're doing stuff, you know, house cleaning, carpentry, things where you're likely, gardening especially, not a bad idea to wear those.
Yeah, okay. Well, I guess it's more than just getting old. It's that I didn't figure I was going to live this long, so I didn't have to worry about sun.
Oh, you were of the live fast, die young, make a beautiful corpse, but then, oops, you didn't die? Well.
Yeah, but I'm long past that, so.
Yes.
But anyway.
I hear the chickens coming home to cluck.
Yes, I remember baking for hours in the sun down at the beach.
Well, look back on those happy times and realize that it wasn't free. Payments come due.
Yes. So,
anyway, if with that much sun exposure, you need to get a good thorough dermatologic exam every year, particularly behind the ears and the places that you wouldn't necessarily be able to see.
Yeah. Okay, well, I appreciate your help and your expertise. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Bye-bye. Well, I think we'll do an email before we go to our next scary sources. This is not really scary. This is from Anna in Columbus, Ohio. And Anna writes, "Dear Dr. Dawn, we're receiving mixed messages re the RSV vaccine." And I guess, you know, just parenthetically speaking, Anna, vaccines are kind of a scary topic. They shouldn't be, but they've become such. Continuing with Anne's letter, "I'm 74, my husband is 76. We're both in fairly good health and travel frequently. My husband has had 3 instances of AFib, resolved by cardioversion. I regularly see an ophthalmologist for glaucoma and dry macular degeneration, but my vision is stable. We brought home a virus from a June Iceland-Norway trip. I'm betting that was a cruise. Started out with headache and a deep cough and took about a month to clear up. I ended up taking an antibiotic for bronchitis. It was not COVID. We tested, but we did not test for flu or RSV. I'll stop to comment right there and say it could have even been pertussis. Bordetella pertussis is a whooping cough in humans. When you get it as an adult, it causes paroxysms of dry coughing with not much phlegm, and they go on, they come as attacks, and they often, you may end up vomiting a little bit up into your mouth. You cough so much. So that is sort of a characteristic of that. There are also atypical pneumonias. So mycoplasma and chlamydia pistache can do that. So those are also things that might cause a persistent cough. And so those are not necessarily viruses. So you're not really, you can't really be sure. Headaches don't really differentiate. If you had headaches and joint pain and muscle aches and then developed the respiratory symptoms, that would be much more characteristic of a viral infection. So we'll never know whether you had flu or RSV. Continuing with Anna, we received our COVID and flu shots in late September. I've read pros and cons via the RSV vaccine. My husband's primary care physician says our age group does not need the vaccine unless we have compromised lungs or on oxygen. We have an overseas trip scheduled in November and want to try to stay healthy. What are your RSV recommendations? Well, the first thing is I disagree, and so does the U.S. The United States Preventative Services Task Force about that. Actually, it recommends that adults 68 years or older receive a single dose of RSV no matter what. And then anyone from 50 upwards who has chronic heart disease, lung disease, kidney disease, diabetes, severe obesity, or any kind of neurologic condition that impairs airway clearance, like difficulty coughing. A lot of people with Parkinson's can't cough very well. RSV is a very safe vaccine. I don't think there are any reasons to be concerned about it. And I would strongly recommend that you both get it. It's important to go into an overseas trip as thoroughly vaccinated. You're spending a lot of good money to get there, and you're also, of course, throwing some carbon into the atmosphere. You might as well enjoy yourself and have it be worthwhile. I want to talk just briefly about the consumer at-home test kits, because you mentioned that you had tested. And I thought, well, I'm going to look and see about rapid antigen tests for RSV. And there is one that purports to do that, but it isn't FDA approved. What is FDA approved is a test called the Pixel. And it's a LabCorp, it's Pixel by LabCorp. It has COVID-19, flu, and RSV. And it's a home collection kit that you mail in, and you get a fairly rapid turnaround time. Within a couple of days, you'll know whether you have any of those three things. And of course, if you're positive for COVID, you're going to have one set of behaviors. There are good rapid tests for flu and COVID. I like the iHealth test because it gives you both flu A and B, and these are over the counter. You can also get the Pixel over the counter at most Walgreens, and the website where I found this also helpfully suggested that if you're sick, you should just use DoorDash and have them go to Walgreens and buy the stuff for you. I did not fact check our local Walgreens, but the fact that there is testing available, I think, is an important bit of follow-up that everybody should think about doing. And if you want to, you can pick up the kit from Walgreens and just sit on it. I looked for RSV point-of-care testing and saw that it's available to medical practitioners. It's going to cost me wholesale about $10 a test. And so I'll probably buy some and keep them around the office for my patients. But I think most urgent cares probably have the ability to test for RSV now. We're doing scary stories this day before Halloween. And my next story is titled, What Happens When Private Equity Takes Over Hospitals? Now, this is from an article published in Democracy Now!, so it's very long and goes into exhaustive detail about all of the nefarious machinations that happen when you let healthcare facilities, particularly if it's the only game in town, be purchased. We're going to talk about some of the financial scams and shell games that these private equity companies do. We're going to talk about two major hospital chains that have gone bankrupt in the last two years. The first one in March of 2024 was Steward Healthcare. It owned 31 hospitals across the country. At the start of this year, Prospect, which owned 16 hospitals when it declared bankruptcy but had fire sailed off quite a bit more. We'll get to that later. The financial conditions of these hospitals has wreaked havoc on the ability of the low-income communities and where both hospitals tended to operate to deliver care even before the bankruptcies. In the Boston Globe, one of Steward's patients wrote, "They died in hallways, in lines, alone." Multiple congressional committees and think tanks have held hearings and released reports and written letters and more reports. I'll jump to the conclusion. Healthcare facilities need to be treated like a public utility, and the laws for public utilities should probably be tightened up a bit as well, but at the minimum, you shouldn't be able to opt out of providing services to a community after you have acquired that responsibility. You buy a utility company, you're now a public utility. Both Steward and Prospect were owned by private equity firms that delivered hefty profits for their investors. Over the decade they owned the hospitals, Steward's owner, Cerberus, the three-headed dog that guards the gates of Hades. Now, that's a nice name for a friendly health corporation, isn't it? They earned over $700 million for their investors. Prospect's owners got $424 million for their investors. And all the board and committee meetings that you can look at center around profits, cost-cutting, acquisition, managing labor expenses, and increasing patient volumes, with little or no discussions of patient outcome or quality of care. For Steward, a just-published study by the Brookings Institution cites 650 documented incidents of deficient care, in some cases leading to death, in that company before its collapse. One example, in January of 2024, because the company was not paying its bills, a vendor repossessed the very equipment needed to stop the woman's internal hemorrhage. So when she had her hemorrhage, she bled to death because they did not have the device to stop the bleeding because they hadn't made their payments on the device. Now, when a hospital that's handing over that kind of money to their investors can't pay their vendors, you know that something is wrong. So what happens now to those hospitals? These hospital systems have been seriously degraded, and who's going to step in and rescue all of the people who need to get their health care at these hospitals? And this was before the cuts to Medicaid, which have been made, and those hospitals were already on the ropes. The people owning them went bankrupt. But here's one of the tricks. I said there was a shell game involved. Well, that shell game is you buy the hospital, you declare bankruptcy, you sell the hospital off cheap, but you keep the land that the hospital is built on. And then you charge whoever else is civic-minded enough or desperate enough. Often these are community entities that really need to keep their hospitals going. So they put together a consortium, but now they get the hospital building, but they don't get the land it's built on, and they're stuck paying money to a landlord. There's a landlord that does this, buying up the land under distressed hospitals called Medical Properties Trust. It's like you sold your house to someone who rented it back to you. You got the money, but now you owe rent. But it gave each of those hospital companies more than $1 billion in immediate cash. Some $350 million a year for Steward and over $100 million a year for Prospect. Of course, that doesn't show up in the same place on the balance sheet. And that, of course, is used to offset the profits. Those large chunks of proceeds from selling the real estate were used to fund the dividends for the private equity owners or repaid additional debt that the company had borrowed in order to fund the dividends from the actual uh, to uh, that were being paid out to the private equity owners. It is a complete shell game and scam. And eventually, when the well runs dry, you declare bankruptcy and just walk away. The article goes into a lot of the specifics and names a lot of names. I'm going to skip over all of that. I did want to point out that the courts are one of our only protections here. But the courts aren't all that vigilant. The Prospect bankruptcy just approved the sale of its California hospitals to a new entity called NOR, which was just registered in Nevada earlier this year. The person listed on NOR's finding is one of the longtime hospital executives for Prospect. He's, you know, like I said, it's a shell game. The basis for the court's decision is that the court can't force MPT to sell real estate it owns to a new buyer, and NOR has a good working relationship with MPT. So nobody's got a good track record here, and the courts are basically letting things happen that shouldn't be allowed to happen. A surprising amount of money can be made by, well, driving a hospital into the ground. 18 states have passed legislation during the last few years that would allow attorney generals greater latitude when healthcare facilities are sold. Some of them create requirements, but Oregon is the only state that routinely actually looks at the book and evaluates the hospital after a transaction. Senator Edward Markey and Bernie Sanders and Richard Blumenthal introduced a bill called the Stop Medical Profiteering and Theft Act, which will prevent health systems from entering into deals with real estate players that weaken their financial security or risk public health. No one is standing up to this at the time, and the hospital infrastructure of the country is deeply, deeply threatening. And we're running into a real problem with medical deserts for women's health care, particularly obstetrical care. So women are having lots of babies in trucks or station wagons trying to get to the hospital when they suddenly go into labor. These are often women who can't afford to go to a major city where the hospital is located and live there for a couple of weeks during their due date. A recent sweeping analysis of nearly 2.8 million pregnancies found that there were nearly 19,000 stillbirths, a rate higher than recorded in the federal data. There's a lot of irregularities in terms of the state laws that interfere with the data that the feds get being accurate. There are also very different criteria for how fetal death certificates are filled out, and I certainly never had any instruction about that, and I wonder how many obstetricians ever did. I'll have to ask. This latest study from Harvard and Mass General Brigham is the largest and most data-rich study of stillbirth to date. So the CDC says it's 1 in every 175, but this study says between 2016 and 2022 it was 1 in 147. But wait, it gets worse. In low-income families, it's 1 in every 112. In areas with a higher proportion of black families compared to white families, it's 1 in 95. That's a pretty significant discrepancy. From 1 to 1 to 1 out of every 147 to 1 out of every 95, that's just wrong. More than 70% of the stillbirths involved a known clinical factor: obesity, substance abuse, or diabetes. The problem is 30% of them had no identifiable risk factor. It's not just simple access to care. It has also to do with whether a woman is able to convince people that she's in trouble. There's a lot of tendency to ignore what women, regardless of what color they are, say. But once you add skin pigment or a lack of skilled English to the thing, doctors tend to have a tendency to ignore the complaints. And this is something we need to deeply work on in medicine and really emphasize the unconscious bias that people bring to the medical encounter from both sides of the fence. One, I won't be treated well, so I don't know how to advocate for myself. I don't believe I will be successful. The other, this person is probably probably lying or exaggerating. Both of these biases need to be trained away. I'm not sure how to do it, but I do know we need to make it a priority. So let's move on just to a kind of scary disease that needs to be addressed. And that's the virus that causes squamous cell carcinoma of the mouth and tongue. Just like cervical cancer, the great majority of these cancers are found to contain human papillomavirus. And human papillomavirus, there are over 60 different ones, but some of them, about 10 of them, cause mutation in the DNA, and over time are known to be substantial cancer risk factors. Young men are at the highest risk for getting squamous cell carcinoma. Women who have sex with women are also at risk. The virus gets into the oral mucosa, obviously through oral genital contact, and females are much more likely to shed the virus just because of their anatomy. They have a lot more of the right kind of skin that the virus can live in. While the major risk factors for squamous cell carcinoma of the mouth are tobacco and alcohol, the use of smokeless tobacco, what I used to call chewing tobacco, in young men, particularly in certain parts of the country, is fairly widespread. And this is a problem because if you have HPV in your mouth, you probably want to kick that particular habit. It's one of the most important things that you can get rid of. Also, hard spirits straight would be another one to rethink. And I don't really care whether it's high-class cognac or low-class rot gut. They both damage DNA. There's now a test that you can purchase that's a saliva test. It's reasonably sensitive, and you can order the test and do it yourself. I believe it's available commercially, or you can get your doctor to order it for you. If the person tests positive, they need to be retested once, and if they persistently have that and they're not clearing the virus, then it's really important that they reduce their risk factors. This is a newly available test. So for those of you who use smokeless tobacco, why, by the way, are we seeing it so much more in young men? Well, quite honestly, for the last 30 years, sexual practices have shifted considerably from what typical sexual practices were in the 1950s. And that has opened up a new channel for its spread of this dangerous virus from the genitals to the mouth. Simple as that. We'll move on to what may probably be our last story for the evening, but it is hopeful. Okay, a clever genetic technique may treat a horrible brain condition called Huntington's disease. It's probably the nastiest inherited illness around. The symptoms are awful. Spasms, involuntary jerking, difficulty swallowing, loss of concentration, depression, mood swings, irritability, personality changes, and then you die. This new treatment was announced in late September using a type of genetic material called a microRNA that halts the manufacture of the protein responsible for causing this. So Huntington's is the result of a strange mutation, kind of a genetic stutter. There are three letters of the genetic code, CAG, that are repeated over and over again in the DNA that encodes a protein called Huntington. This is there in everybody. Now, unlike most genetic disorders for which a faulty gene must be inherited from both parents for someone to be affected, like cystic fibrosis, for example, Huntington's requires, or sickle cell, Huntington's requires only one parent to have it for it to be passed on. And it doesn't show up until middle age because the protein that is produced takes a long time to accumulate and kill the brain cells. Everyone has some of these CAG repeats in their Huntington genes, but when there are too many of them, you get into trouble. Something goes wrong with the resulting protein, and it accumulates in the cells and wrecks them, and these cells are in the brain, but it happens very slowly. And like I said, it appears in middle age. If the number of genetic repeats a person is born with exceeds 36, the repeat chain may lengthen over the course of life until the resulting protein becomes toxic. If it contains 40 or more repeats, they will definitely accumulate to high levels of the toxic protein. And what's going on there? Well, the toxic protein has a different shape. And because it has a different shape, it can't be removed from the cells. It doesn't fit into the garbage disposal, the lysosome. The exact mechanism, so exactly how it kills the cells, not clear, but, you know, if you're waiting through lots of garbage, a whole bunch of normal functions are going to be suppressed, and the disease continues. The researchers at Unicure announced that they have done this. They have blocked the protein. They used a microRNA molecule that they called AMT-130. It's generated by a virus that's inserted into the brains of the Huntington's patients. So they're actually putting this into the brains. They use an MRI-guided stereotactic delivery. In other words, they hold the person's head in a brace, and then they make a small incision and go exactly into the right spot, which is in a deeply buried structure in the midbrain called the striatum. And they also hit the caudate and the putamen. So once they've gotten there, the viral genes turn out this AMT-130. This is like a RNA vaccine, but in this case, it's a microRNA, a very short RNA. And because it's in a virus and the virus is otherwise not toxic, it continues to be made. Now, why does this work? Well, because the microRNA is the exact mirror image of the RNA for the evil protein. And so because of that, it gloms onto it. And that RNA will not fit in a ribosome. It cannot run through like a ticker tape and a protein gets spit out. No. What happens is that virus that RNA is a double-stranded RNA, which is no bueno, and the cells will immediately go after it and break down any of these double-stranded RNA structures. So you've gotten rid of the thing that's being overproduced. It's quickly recognized as alien and destroyed. And the trial that was done included 29 people. It's been going for 3 years. And this is the big news, folks. There's been a 75% slowing of disease progression, according to one widely used measure of Huntington's, and a 60% slowing of progression by another. It reported, too, that a biochemical signal associated with disease severity, which can be sampled from CSF in a spinal tap, was also reduced, and there were few worrying side effects. There are probably 100,000 people in America who carry the overlong repeat segments, of whom 40,000 already have symptoms. So this is, first of all, a wonderful advance into a previously completely untreatable disease, and just like a miracle for those who have that hanging over their heads. You may remember a musician. There's a couple of albums of him here at the station, Woody Guthrie. And Woody Guthrie had Huntington's disease. So he died young of this disease. I think that this is a pretty good place to end the program on a positive note. I hope that you've enjoyed the scary stories, and I'll be back next week. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.